Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with celebrated New York City jazz pianist, composer, and educator, the great Pete Malinverney. He opened up about his latest 2022 CD, On the Town, plays Leonard Bernstein. It's a homage he has wanted to put onto record for many years, ever since he met Leonard in person while performing at an opening night party for a production of the opera Tosca at the Met in New York. He has been a fixture on the New York City jazz scene since moving there in the early 80s from his hometown of Niagara Falls, New York, where he began classical piano studies at the age of 6. Since moving to New York City, he has recorded 16 times as a leader, and he's got many, many more stories to tell. Enjoy this story.
Well, hey, thank you for taking a minute out for Neon Jazz today. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and it's just an honor to talk to you. So I always appreciate so much people that are out there playing the music and keeping it in people's ears. I almost think it's missionary work, you know?
It's just standing on the shoulders of giants. I love it, for sure. You're playing the music of Leonard, and you got a grandiose new album now during a time where we need music more than ever before on planet Earth. Talk to me a little bit about how you feel about this project and the timing of it and all of that right now.
The liner notes kind of tell a story of how I met and got to hang out one evening with Leonard Bernstein. A few years ago, I was playing a solo piano gig in a kind of a fancy restaurant, and the staff told me that the next night I should be ready to play opera music because they were having some folks in. And so I grew up playing classical piano, but I didn't really know opera. I know that it's difficult to play arias with opera singers because the phrasing that they use is really quite special. And so I had no real experience with that at all, even though when I went to college, the singer I worked with the most in the college big band and in small group jazz settings was Renee Fleming, right? But we were doing standards and, you know, other jazz stuff. So I had never really ever played with an opera singer. So the next morning I went upstairs and knocked on the door of this woman who lived above me who sang opera, and I told her my predicament, and she gave me a book of arias to practice, you know. So I went back downstairs and dove in, and, you know, every now and then the phone would ring and she'd say, okay, that one's too slow, or, you know, that one's too fast, or try to feel that, this, whatever, you know, because I just wanted to be, I wanted to be correct, you know, I wanted to be idiomatic with what I was playing. So I was as prepared as I could be in just one day, and I went to the gig. And it turned out that as opening night of the Franco Zeffirelli production of Tosca at the Metropolitan Opera, and present were Placido Domingo, who was in the opera, and Hildegard Behrens, who was the soprano, and just a slew of, you know, noted people. And in walks Leonard Bernstein. So I started to play a tune of his, Lucky to Be Me. And he heard me right away, but said, I'll be right back. And he went into the men's room. And it happened that a buddy of mine was in there at the same time. And, you know, when you're in the men's room, you never look at the other guys in there. You know, you just don't. But yeah. Bernstein was whistling Lucky to Be Me. And my buddy heard, he said, oh, that's a nice song. And Bernstein goes, thanks, I wrote it. <You know>? Yeah, yeah. So the kid out there, the piano player's playing it. And so my buddy tells, oh, that's my friend, you know. And so they got talking. So Bernstein comes out of the bathroom, out of the men's room, and he strides over to the piano, loud, Malinverney, I know all about you. And he comes up on the stage, he grabs me and gives me a big kiss on the cheek. And, you know, we started talking, and he was just so cool. You know, I grew up, you know, checking out the young people's concerts and all the various recorded lectures, which I had heard, seen some on TV, but mostly had heard in LP form. You know, I knew from those that he at least presented as a person who passionately loved music and was happy to share what he knew in ways that would be understandable to the general public. And I still think there are at least a couple of generations of people who were brought to music, either as performers or lovers of it, by Leonard Bernstein. Anyway, so he kind of hung out by the piano, you know, and the place is full of, you know, like I said, you know, noted people, but he hung out with the piano player. Betty Comden and Adolph Green, with whom he wrote On the Town and Wonderful Town, were at this party. So he went over and got them and brought them over and introduced them to me. And it was just really sweet. You know, it was one of these gigs that you do that you never forget. You know, I mean, in New York, you know, you see all kinds of people, right? But that was a special one. I don't know, short time after that, I was playing at another place down in Soho, and the bartender and I were friendly. And he, one time he came, and his wife, who was personal chef to Bernstein, I guess Bernstein had given her a sheaf of music paper, I don't know, to take notes on or something, I don't know. But anyway, she had saved, and she gave it to this fella, his name was James, and he gave it to me. He said, we want you to have this. So I had this sheaf of lined music paper that I just kept for many years. And around, let's see, I don't know, a couple years ago on Bernstein's centenary year, I was curating a jazz series at the Performing Arts Center at Purchase College, SUNY Purchase, where I teach. And I had booked Joe Lovano to come up, and I wrote four horn arrangements to feature Joe on a bunch of Bernstein's songs. And it was great, you know, it went very well. But all the research I had done into the songs and trying to find all different ways to play them, it felt as though it were wasted if I was, you know, just going to look for an opportunity to present a four-horned thing, you know. So I started playing the tunes on trio gigs, and I found entirely new ways in to that because, of course, you know, the trio is a more, let's say, agile form, right? You can go different directions with less warning and out of nowhere, sort of. And I really started to enjoy that. Then I felt it was time to make a new trio recording. And so I thought, okay, this is what it's going to be. And I got Ugana Okegwo, who's a wonderful bassist with whom I work a lot here in New York, and the great drummer Jeff Hamilton, who, even though he lives out west, we had been in contact through the years because he reached out to me when I first made, my first recording was a trio date that we did out at Rudy Van Gelder's with Mel Lewis on drums and Dennis Irwin at the bass. And Jeff had written to me way back then saying, you know, well, Mel was a mentor of his, and how much he liked the record and blah, blah, blah. So we'd kind of been in loose contact over the years, and I said, you know, this is the time to play with Jeff. So I organized a couple of rehearsals and three or four gigs, and then the record date at you know, it was like a 4 or 5 day stretch where Jeff flew in and we did all these things and then finally went in on the Monday after a weekend of gigs, went in to Van Gelder's on that Monday. And made the date. And it felt like all that preparation, you know, really thinking about the music and thinking of, oh, and I had written all the arrangements for the trio date on that lined paper. I just felt it was sort of ordained, you know, to go that way. And so we went into the studio, and after all the preparation and the rehearsing and everybody's desire to agree, and find interesting ways through the music, it was really, I think, the freest record date I've ever played. You know, it just kind of flowed. And we did maybe two takes of everything. Some things only one take. And I'm actually really happy with the record. You know, your musician listeners will know what I mean when I say it's really the first thing I've ever recorded that I can actually, you know, listen to. I actually like it. And because, you know, when I listen to it, I'm not just listening to myself, which is always tough, but I'm listening to the interplay between the three of us, you know, and it's, I really love it, man. I love to hear how Ugana and Jeff, who had never played really before we did all the rehearsals and the gigs, how they're interacting and how each of us is really trying to make the other sound well. Because that's the thing, really, right, when you improvise or when you have a conversation, you always hope to somehow facilitate the other person to be at their best and at their most open and honest, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what happened. And I think it the record to me is just the statement I wanted to make about what I thought of Bernstein as a great musician and really a humanitarian and a very generous collaborator, teacher, an open-minded person.
So what are you hoping the listener that either downloads or buys this gets from this experience?
Well, I hope they enjoy the music, you know. You know, when you're planning a set of music or a recording, you try to include music of different feels, yeah, different moods, you know, and you try to program them in such a way that, okay, after you hear this kind of song, you know, let's say it's up-tempo or whatever, right? What are you ready for? What does your heart want to hear next? You know, and so you kind of have to trust that instinct when you're pacing the recording or, as I said, a set of music. So I hope that the listener will feel carried along with us, because that's the thing. You play four people, right? And I'm hoping that they feel when they listen to it. And I think they will, you know, because we were certainly in the moment when we played. And I hope, you know, the listener will get that feeling, that they'll feel happy from it, that there will be moments of maybe, you know, deep emotion. Because we do songs like Lonely Town and Somewhere on here, which, you know, they really are very evocative. The way he wrote them, the melodies are just exquisite. And so I hope that they, you know, they allow themselves to feel. And I think if they do, they will. The thing about Leonard Bernstein is, I mean, we know of his, you know, erudition as far as musicianship goes. We know what a great composer. He was actually a good pianist as well. And conductor he was, and how in-depth he got with everything he did. And yet, when you think of his songs, they're eminently singable. You know, like,
yeah,
New York, New York, da da boo doo da boo doo 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 boo boo doo doo da. I mean, that's such a simple sounding melody, but when you look at how it's constructed, and when you check out the harmonies he put under this stuff, that's where it's fun for a player, a musician, to really kind of dig in and find new stuff to play. You know what I mean? It's like,
absolutely.
It sounds simple, but it is anything but.
Yeah, absolutely. So Speaking of giving the crowds the goods and enjoying this process, talk to me about how you got into music, where you were born and raised, childhood, that kind of a thing, the beginning for you.
Okay. Well, I was born in Niagara Falls, New York. My dad was a pipe fitter, steam fitter, union worker. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, so I had kind of a, you know, normal middle-class childhood, you know. I mean, I suppose there were times early on in my dad's work. Well, I know there were times early on when he would be out of work for a few months, you know, because once you sign on to be, to work and do union work, you know, you have to do that exclusively. And it takes a while to sort of break in, if you will. And so there were times I know that they were kind of struggling. But after a while, it was fine, and he was working steadily. And we got a piano. There was someone in our church who knew of someone who was moving to a small apartment and couldn't take the piano with them. So we got this little grand piano, and I started lessons when I was 6 years old with a woman named Laura Copia, who was sort of a famous, well-known teacher up there, who Brooked no baloney. She was hardcore. You know, she came right out of the Russian school. So it was very, very strict, and she paid real close attention to making sure that you were technically proficient. And I think that's the right path for a youngster because, you know, when you're little, there's really no way for you to, I guess, feel to the extent just because of your lack of, you know, emotional yardage, you know, mileage. You can't really feel certain things maybe as strongly as you might as you get older. In fact, one time I remember I was working on something. You know, she was of Polish descent, so there was a lot of Chopin in my early youth, you know. I was working on something with her and, you know, just trying to get the notes and the fingerings and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I got it pretty together, and she said, okay, Peter, well, that's about as well as you're going to be able to play it until you've had your heart broken.
Right. Wow.
What a, right?
Very heavy.
And then I remember when I was about, I don't know, 30 or so, I remember calling her, well, Miss Copia, I can play that Chopin now. Yeah.
That's
but anyway,
crazy.
So I studied with her till I was out of high school, you know, so it was a long time, from 12 years I studied with her. And it was every week, summers, every time, all the time. You know, you were allowed to have 2 weeks off a year because it was her income. You know, she didn't want people taking summers off and everything, and required a certain dedication. And, you know, I guess I showed aptitude for it, you know, and I would play recitals and all that. But really, the biggest opportunity I had to play, honestly, though, was at church. Growing up in church, because, you know, whenever I was learning a new piece, my folks would call the pastor, who was a family friend, and say, okay, you need music Sunday. So he would say, yeah, I haven't played during the offering, you know. So I would play some Bach or Chopin or Beethoven, whatever it was, during the offering, you know. And the people were just so kind, you know, and it was great to have that opportunity to feel what that's like to share the music. You know, because if you're a horn player or a strings player, you get the opportunity to know other musicians, right? Because you're sitting in a string section, or you're sitting in the trombone or trumpet section or saxophone section in high school band or orchestra. But for a pianist, it's solitary, man. You know, I didn't know any other young piano players. So that consequently led me to, you know, I was started to play ball and all that in high school. I was playing football and basketball, and I was running track, and you know, I was kind of starting to lose interest a little bit. And then a cousin of mine and myself, we had a band together with some other guys, and you know, we were playing like funk music and like that, and some of the rock music of the day. So that was good because, you know, I started to feel that camaraderie you get when you play music with people. There was like a dichotomy there, though, because on one hand, it was fun to have buddies you would play music with. And on the other hand, I was taking these classical piano lessons. And what I liked about playing with the fellas was that camaraderie and the ability to kind of play things differently every time. But with the classical thing, I liked because, you know, just how you would curve a finger or how you would use your wrist or whatever it was would really dictate the sound and dynamics and everything. And so both had strengths, but of course the rock thing, it was like everybody had their amps up to 11, as they say in Spinal Tap. And the classical thing, no matter what you think or feel, you still have to play the note on the page. So when I went away to college, to music school, I was walking down the hall early on in my freshman year, and I heard something coming from a room, practice room, and it sounded really beautiful, you know? So I opened the door, and there were these guys, like about five people in there playing. And it was like, oh, this is it. This is it. Because it was, dynamics were important. You could see that everybody was listening to each other. There was a certain fineness in what they were doing, you know? And so I determined to try to learn how to play jazz. And so that's what I did. I worked hard at it. You know, I was lucky enough to be at a college upstate New York where bars, you know, the drinking age at the time was 18. So, and there were four colleges in the area. So consequently, there were a lot of bars and rapscallers and like that, you know, where you could play. So we were playing like four or five nights a week. And that's really where I started to, I guess, understand, you know, the rules, not just, hey, I think I'll play jazz, like, oh, it's wide open, which of course it is, but it's an earned freedom. You know, you really have to work hard to learn the language. The idiom is not an easy one. So then after college, I moved to New York and really found myself in the deep end. You know, boy, I have to say, when I first moved to New York, it didn't feel like the most welcoming place because, you know, I didn't know anyone. You know, I think back on it and I just wonder, like, what made me stick around? You know, like I wanted it so badly, you know, so I'd go hear these great musicians, you know, on any given night I could hear, you know, Tommy Flanagan, Hank Jones, Dexter Gordon, just, you know, all of them, great masters. And I would go home and practice harder and this and that and the other. But initially, the only gigs I could get were those solo piano gigs in restaurants that I described to you where I met Bernstein. And then after a while, I would pester someone until I got a trio gig. And then I would just hire people who I thought were well-known at the time, you know. And it was good because that's a great way to learn, is playing with people better than you, you know. And very few of them were all that kind about, oh, that's good, young man. I can see what you're trying to do. You know, there wasn't that much of that. You know, so it was sort of, you know, learn or die, you know, learn or go back home. And so I just hung in there. And, you know, I've been really blessed because over time I was able to build up a nice, you know, playing career and, you know, took it on myself to make some recordings. And then it's, you know, not that you're not always working hard, because I am, but it, you know, that sort of thing sort of gathers steam, if you will. You know, the more you do, the more is available to you. Opportunities present themselves because you've gotten yourself into the arena. And it's been a long process for which I'm really grateful. You know, so these days, you know, it's funny because now I play with people, and very often, you know, I mean, I very seldom play with people older than I now. You know, play with a lot of colleagues my own age, but also, you know, many that are younger. As I said, I run the Jazz Studies program at SUNY Purchase, and we have just wonderful young musicians coming through. I try to engender a feeling of family in the program because I don't want these kids going through the kind of dues, unnecessary, I think, vibing that that I felt when I moved to New York. I try to make them understand that to be supportive of each other is far more effective toward becoming the artist you're capable of or destined to be. You know, so I'll end up playing, like just the other night, I played some trio stuff with a couple of folks who graduated from Purchase, you know, and who are out here dealing, you know, making a living playing the music, which gives me such a good feeling. And here's the other thing, you know, you asked about this recording, you know, dropping at this particular time. I think that we're in a new golden age of jazz music. When I play dates in New York now, I see a lot of young people in the audiences. And, you know, when I first came, it was everybody was, they were all older than me because the people then who were in the clubs were, you know, people who maybe had grown up listening to Dave Brubeck and Miles Davis Kind of Blue and like that, you know, in their sort of formative years. But now, like, the young folk are digging everything because it's all at their fingertips, right? They can go online and check out Bud Powell. They can see videos of, you know, Miles playing or whatever it is, you know, Monk. They can see like long videos of it. And for us, it was like, you know, you would hope you could get a record, you know, you go to the record store and see what they had, and I had a big collection of records, but it wasn't the same as just at your fingertips, type in Bud Powell and sit there and watch videos all day, you know, and look at how his hands looked, et cetera, et cetera. Look at the communication, the visual communication between band members, you know, as they would look at each other when different parts of the form would come up. Okay, what are we going to do now? And like that, you know? Yeah, I just think it's kind of cool because I'm getting a lot of nice notes from former students and other musicians I see around New York who are like, yeah, man, I'm digging this. And I'm hoping that it will turn them on to, you know, really the greatness of Leonard Bernstein.
So you've done such a wonderful job of orchestrating so many things that I did actually want to ask you. But I got one question I want to ask you, and it's this. Everyone has a perception or an idea of you, your family, your friends, your fans. But ultimately, you live your life. You have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
You know, my mom just passed about 3 days ago. And it was really a surprise, you know. And I talk to her at least once every day. And I was just down in Florida where she lived, kind of taking care of some business. So I'm going to have to go back down there. And I guess over the past few days, I've been seeing myself as her and my dad's son. And how does that mean I move through the world, you know? And I see myself as someone who does not shirk responsibility, who shows up, you know, and takes care of business and works real hard in the practice room. And who loves music, and I want to see the world through musical eyes, if you will. And music, of course, branches out to everything. Like when I'm looking out the window now and all the trees are bare, of course, you know. And I'm looking at the trees and, you know, I look for organizational sort of clues, right? I look at the angles of the branches and, you know, the exact color of the sky behind there. It looks like we're going to get a snowstorm today. So I kind of see myself as going through life trying to have an open heart to the music, to the world, and to, most importantly, the people around me, and to try to prepare myself as instrument, and that is by practicing and by, you know, trying to be open all the time, as one who, when I walk onto the bandstand or I walk into the studio or into the classroom, that I trust, you know, I trust the voices I hear, you know, so to speak. I feel and act. I think that's really, you know, the most important thing. I mean, yeah, okay, I'm an artist, I'm a pianist, I'm a composer, I'm an arranger, I'm a teacher, I do all those things, of course. I'm a dad, have been a son to two wonderful parents, you know. I want to believe I was a good husband to my wife who passed away a few years ago. But I see myself really as a person who lives life musically.
Beautiful. I love that answer, man. Hey, thank you for opening up today. Thanks for the music and taking some time out. I really appreciate it. Good luck with it and the return to the stage.
Thank you, brother. All the best.
Take care.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Pete for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.